You are looking live. That is the city of Moscow on a beautiful, bright, sunny day with a little bit of a nip in the air, as they say. We are so excited about everything that is happening. So is most of Russia. As a matter of fact, they read the news. They know what's going on. And they know that tomorrow their president will be sitting down with the president of the United States to try and figure out exactly what these two gentlemen are going to be able to do to try and bring peace in Ukraine, if they're able to do that. I am joined on this day by none other than Scott Ritter, who's going to be taking us through this conversation here in Moscow. You know, I'm thinking, Scott, and I'll give everybody the formal introduction about how you are if they don't already know you, which I think they probably do. But this is important for you. This is an important day for you. What are your impressions on this day as you find yourself here in Moscow?
Well, first of all, we're looking at a period in time where America and Russia are trying to mend relations, move forward in a positive fashion. It's not the first time this has happened. In fact, my very first visit to Moscow was in June of 1988. Ronald Reagan was the president. I'm a Reagan Republican. Trust me, I was anti-communist, anti-Russian as they come. But somehow they picked me to be on the first inspection team to come to Russia. I worked at the city of Votkinsk, monitoring a missile factory. I was part of the advance party, so we came 2 weeks before the treaty came into force on the 1st of July. But before the treaty could come into force, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, they signed the treaty in December of 1987, but now they had to ratify it. The treaty had to be ratified by the United States Senate, by the Soviet legislative process. So Ronald Reagan came here to Moscow. So to me, when I see Moscow, when I come to Moscow, it's always been about not entering the enemy capital, but entering the home of a friend, a colleague.
And that's different than the way most Americans see it.
100%. They come here and they're like, oh, I'm in Mordor. I come here and I actually feel comfortable. I get off the airplane, I'm like, I'm here where I need to be, because my entire life has been, the mission of my entire adult life since 1987 has been trying to make good relations between first the Soviet Union and the United States,
I've heard you say that.
Russia and the United States. So here I am in Moscow. I look out that these are the people that I am friends with, and I want the American people to be friends with. This is the whole key. America has to learn to treat the Russian people as friends. In order to do that, you have to know who they are. You have to learn about them.
Yes.
We're infected with Russophobia in the United States. Americans are taught to be afraid of the Russians. Hey, guys, there ain't nothing to fear here. These are good people, kind people, intelligent people, culture people, and more importantly, they want to be friends with the United States. But they don't want to surrender to the United States. They're not going to bend the knee to the United States.
And in many ways, they're much like us. If not, I'll dare say, in many ways, they're a lot like what we want to be. And we'll get into that a little bit more, as we will, why this is so personal for Scott. His ability to be here, which is something he would not have been able to do a year ago, just like Mr. Putin would not be able to be in the United States a year ago. And that's important as well. We're going to delve into all of this. We're going to do it right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. So you should know now, as we make this formal introduction of Scott Ritter, that he is a Marine and he's also a UN weapons inspector. I could probably go on and on about all the accomplishments. He is, for those few of you who don't know who he is, who don't follow him, he's become one of the most respected voices on the internet on all things geopolitics, but most of all, the situation with Ukraine, the United States, and Russia. So it's important for us to be able to sit down and have this discussion on this day on The Sanchez Effect here with Scott. And Scott, you know, one of the things that I first wanted to ask you about was the fact that you're here in Russia. I know you probably are asked by lots of organizations to come and speak. You've been asked by an organization to come here and be a part of that. You could tell us a little bit about that. But more importantly, what I just mentioned to my audience, that you would not have been able to do this under the Biden administration, correct?
Not only that, I was stopped under the Biden administration. Look, in 2022, in the lead up to the special military operation, people became interested in Russia again. And, you know, I'm a writer. I'm not a natural podcaster. It's not my thing. But I did a couple podcasts, and they were picked up by the Russian audience. And I'm talking about millions of views. It exploded. And this led the Russian people to rediscover who I was. And I guess they liked me. And I got an invitation from a good friend of mine, or a guy who became a good friend of mine, totally unknown at the time, Alexander Zirianov, a businessman out of Novosibirsk. And he said, I invite you to Russia. I was hesitant. I mean, you know.
As most Americans would be.
You are afraid of that which you don't understand.
Of course.
And I had studied Russia from, I knew Russia from the Soviet Union times, but it's been 30 years. And so now I'm like, well, gosh, do I go to Russia? But I went. It was one of the best journeys of my life, May of 2023. I was here during the May Day celebrations. But I got to travel Russia, see Novosibirsk, Irkutsk, Ekaterinburg, Volgograd, Kazan, St. Petersburg, Grozny, and Sevastopol. And it was such a wonderful experience. It was a journey, I call it, of discovering the Russian soul. Because if Americans have a hard time understanding this, the Russians actually have a soul. Even the Russians can't actually define what it is, but it exists. It's there. It's who they are. And I felt I needed to try and figure this out. So I had this wonderful journey. Alexander invited me back in December of 2023, extending to January 2024. And I did this journey, too. Another fantastic experience. I went to the Donbass, saw the SMO.
As it has been for me, by the way.
Oh, it's just, it's a mind-blowing. Umopromachitsilno, I think, is the Russian term, mind-bending. But then they said, you know, Alexander's like, you need to come back again. We need to do the big tour. So we were preparing for the big tour. I was invited to speak at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And then after that was a 40-day tour of Russia, 16 cities. We're going to do podcasts from each city. And when I arrived at the airport, I was literally getting ready to board the airplane. And there were three armed agents of the Customs and Border Patrol. And they pulled me aside. They said, hand over your passport.
I took, this is, when you arrived back in the United States?
No, I was on my way to St. Petersburg.
Oh.
That I was supposed to speak.
Right.
And they took my passport.
Where were you? What city were you in?
I was in New York City.
In New York City?
Yeah.
So before you got on a plane in New York City, customs stopped you.
And took my passport. I said, on whose authority? They said, orders of the State Department. I said, show me the order. They said, no. I said, give me a receipt for my passport. They said, no. So now I can't travel. They didn't charge me.
That's crazy.
They sent me home. So
I didn't know that. They stopped you at the airport.
Literally five steps from getting on the airplane.
Wow. And during the Biden administration.
Correct.
Yeah.
2 months later, on August 7th, and that's an important day because here we are in August, 40 FBI agents raided my house. They accused me of being a Russian agent, me working for Russia. I love Russia. Guys, I ain't going to work for you.
Yeah.
Okay, I work for me. I work for the United States.
You're not an agent.
I'm an American patriot.
I'm not an agent. I'm a journalist.
But we believe that it's important for good relations.
Yes.
And what happened is the Biden administration had criminalized free speech. They stopped me from traveling because they didn't want me to speak at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum.
Damn.
And they didn't want me to have these podcasts. And now they raided my house. They accused me of being an agent of RT. At the same time they raided my house, they raided the home of a RT producer in Miami. And they questioned.
By the way, last time I checked, RT does not employ agents.
No. but they raided and they questioned her about her relationship with me as if she was controlling me. They shut down Dmitry Symes, who was there. What they had criminalized free speech. There was no longer free speech in America.
Yeah.
I said, what am I guilty of? Speaking about wanting peaceful relations. They said, no, that makes you an agent. You're trying to manipulate the election of the United States.
No, you're not.
Well, I said, of course I am. I'm an American citizen.
Right.
I mean, every vote is a manipulation.
Sure.
My vote is for somebody, against somebody else. But also, my whole thing at the time I was running a campaign, the candidates have to earn my vote. I don't give my vote.
Yeah.
And so I had started an operation I call Operation Dawn. What would you as an American voter be willing to do to defend democracy, defend America, to defend the world through your vote in November? Operation Dawn. It was very successful, kicked it off. It was about getting Americans to make preventing nuclear war one of the top priorities in the election.
Yeah.
And this was a threat to the Biden administration. So they tried to do it. I didn't stop Operation Dawn. It was very successful. We actually ended up getting the Trump administration to commit. look, the CIA said in November of last year there was an over 50% chance there'd be a nuclear war between Russia and the United States by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The way things are going, I talked to members of Congress, and they said the Biden administration was ready to have a nuclear war with Russia. They had made the decision that if that's what needs to happen, it's going to happen.
Freaking morons. What's that's idiocy?
It's lunacy. But through Operation Dawn and other pressure, and I'll take credit for this, we got Donald Trump Jr. And RFK Jr., got them to write an op-ed piece that was published in The Hill that said Trump will work to prevent nuclear war, to prevent World War III, to promote arms
Good
control.
For you.
And then through intervention in Congress.
I didn't know that, Scott. Good for
as
you.
As part of Operation Dawn, we got Donald Trump to commit in December that he would reverse the policy of Biden's using the TACMS missiles.
Mm.
Donald Trump made a statement. I said it's very important, my belief, that Trump make a statement right now so that the Russians understand that there's no need to go to nuclear war right now. Because Russia just put out a new nuclear doctrine, and Biden was crossing every red line.
Yeah.
And so Operation Dawn was a great success. But I was still limited because I couldn't go to Russia.
Yeah.
I fought hard. I finally got my passport back. I got it back on my birthday, July 15th. And the first thing I did is I called up the National Unity Club. And I said, what are you guys doing in August? Now, just so you know, why is August important to me? It's the one-year anniversary of the FBI raiding my house. So what are you doing in August? I need to, my first thing with this passport, the first thing
I'm
going
to
do, going to Russia.
Good for you.
I'm going to Russia, and I'm going to resume the people-to-people diplomacy.
Yeah.
And they were so great. I mean, this week, I'm exhausted, but that's a good exhaustion, because if you're going to work for peace, you might as well, if I'm coming to Russia, I'm not here as a tourist. I'd love to be here as a tourist.
Yeah.
But I'm here to work. I'm here to promote peace. These guys are making maximum use. We're having great effect. It's been a wonderful journey. But what I've been doing on this trip is, for Operation Dawn...
And that's the National Unity Club that you're here at their behest right now.
Correct. But just so everybody knows, I paid for my ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I paid for my hotel. I've paid for this whole trip.
Yeah.
They're helping me. You need help when you're in Russia. They're helping me facilitate meetings, and that's priceless. You can't put a price on what they're doing. Yeah. But anybody who thinks for a second that the Russians have flown me here and putting me up and all that, that I'm a tool of Russia, no. This is a partnership for peace.
And by the way, even if they were, so what?
Oh, I know, but the U.S. government has.
Well, I understand. I just wanted our audience to know that it's
No, it's happened before.
You know,
Alexander Zirianov paid for my flight over here first time.
Right.
It's cool. But Operation Dawn, one of the things we do is we made these challenge coins, and we used it to promote the program of stopping nuclear war.
What does that say?
Well,
Dawn?
I'm giving it to you. First of all, we got to shake hands. It's a challenge coin.
Oh my God!
So we got to shake hands. This means now you're committing to the challenge coin promise. And that is, if I ever meet you in a bar, this is a military thing. If I ever meet you in a bar.
I don't go to bars. Yes, I do.
You're lucky. Because if I meet you and I put my challenge coin on the table, if you don't have yours, you're buying me a drink.
Oh, my God.
But if I put my challenge coin on the table and you match it, I buy you a drink. So there's the challenge.
That is so nice.
It's a military tradition. But this is a coin we did to bring attention to Operation Dawn. And the reason why I wanted to bring it to Russia.
Says, save democracy, save America, save the world.
Through your vote in November. And then on the back is say no to nuclear war.
Say yes to peace and say no to nuclear war.
Yep.
Make your vote count. That's beautiful, man.
So I brought it here because while the Russian, the U.S. government, just so you know the importance of this, they accused me of working with the Russians to manipulate the U.S. election.
Yeah.
That coin represents an American initiative to make democracy work. It's our duty as citizens to decide what we support, what we don't support. That was an American initiative. But it's essential when we speak of stopping nuclear war that we have to work with the Russians. So
yeah.
I brought that coin to Russia, and I'm giving it out to people in Russia just to say, again, to the United States government, if you're watching, you can't shut me up. You will never shut me up. I'm an American citizen. I have freedom of speech, and I have chosen to come here on my free will to promote peace between the United States and Russia. Pound sand.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah,
you know.
I know. I respect you greatly for what you do.
I mean,
and it takes great courage, first of all, for you to be here. I mean, this can't be easy for you, and it can't be easy for your family.
No.
But
no.
This is the most important job. We're making history. We're living in the time of history. I mean,
somebody's got to tell these truths.
Yeah.
And when the Biden administration said you're not allowed to practice your craft as a journalist, I said, are you kidding me? All I do is I have a show and I go on the air and I tell truths. Well, you can't do it. Well, then I'll go there and do it.
Yeah.
And that's the decision I've made.
And you know who deserves props? Look, back in the United States, I'm one of the harshest critics of President Trump. You know, you've
yes,
heard me.
Yes.
I will criticize President Trump in the United States because that's my duty and responsibility as an American. If I have a problem, I am obligated as a citizen to hold my elected officials accountable for what they do in my name.
Right.
But President Trump came in as a defender of free speech. And one of the first things he did is sign an executive order saying they're going to stop the weaponization of law enforcement, which is what happened to me, the weaponization of law enforcement.
And potentially me. I could have been in jail, too.
Well, fortunately, I didn't go to jail.
Right.
There was no crime.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was intimidation. And trust me, it's pretty intimidating when 40 FBI agents come to your house.
It's almost like being in jail.
It's almost like, well, during the time you're there, you are in jail.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump signed that executive order, and I'm here. Trust me, when I was getting ready to board the airplane in JFK, I kept looking for the Customs and Border Protection. But I got on the airplane. I'm here. Free speech is free again.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump deserves all the credit in the world for
that. You know, it's funny you say that. I kind of feel the same way. And thank you for saying that you think it's courageous what I've done. My family does, too. Or some of them think it's crazy.
It's even more courageous to wear those socks, but that's okay.
Thank you very much. In case you guys haven't seen them, I think it's hip and cool. But I'm from Miami. We wear socks like this.
Yes, you do.
He's a military guy. He doesn't get it. I maybe wouldn't have made a different choice if Biden were still in office or if Kamala Harris were in office than the decision I made when Trump got elected. I'll just be honest with you, and I've never said this on the air, but since we're talking as friends, I have confidence that his administration, be it as it is, and lately he's been very neoconish, but that aside, I still have confidence in his ability to carry out a more freer America than the America we had under the Biden administration.
We didn't have a free America under the Biden administration.
Yeah.
Free speech is the cornerstone of America, the First Amendment. Without that, we aren't Americans. And just so people understand, free speech isn't something the government gives to us. Our Constitution is clear that this is an unalienable right, God-given right.
Yes.
And that the American people will not cede free speech to the government. The government has no voice, no say. We get to speak. That's what makes us Americans, as imperfect as we are.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say you have too much free speech. That's your problem, not mine. My issue is that as an American, I must be allowed to speak. That is a fundamental freedom. And under the Biden administration, they weaponized it. They criminalized it. They shut it down.
Isn't that crazy? You're talking about the United States of America.
Yeah.
First Amendment, hello, Bill of Rights.
And I mean, at least as far as, look, I have issues with the Trump administration about Gaza and what they're doing with Palestine. And they, again, I don't want to get into constitutional law, but constitutional rights apply not just to U.S. citizens, but non-U.S. citizens when they're in the United States of America. So free speech applies to anybody in the United States. You should have the right to say what you want, not to commit crimes, not to commit actions, not to conspire against the government, but free speech is free. And he's shutting down the free speech rights of non-U.S. citizens, and I have a problem with that because then that's a chilling impact on others. But when it comes to Russia, which is my bailiwick, the Biden administration literally criminalized it. I was being investigated with crimes that could have put me in jail for up to 15 years. And the way the U.S. justice system works is if they make the decision to prosecute, you're screwed. No individual citizen, definitely me, has the resources necessary to hire the legal team that can navigate the federal justice system.
You know, there's an expression for that. You can beat the rap, but you can't beat the rhyme.
You can't. So
they'll destroy you.
But, you know, I made it clear, I mean, the same day the FBI raided me, you might have seen it, I went out as soon as they left my house, and I told the camera, I said, you picked the wrong Marine. If you think I'm going to be intimidated, think I'm going to be quiet, that's not going to happen. You want a war, we got a war. This is a war about free speech. This is a fundamental war in defense of the United States of America. And even the Biden administration couldn't crack that bubble.
This is a great day, man. This is your vindication. I mean, after going through all of that. And look at this. Look where you are.
Well, I think there's some people in America going, yeah, he's that red square. You're damn right I am. Because, A, it's beautiful. This is history. It's history. It's beautiful. You know, I walked Washington, D.C.
It's important.
It's important. You've walked Washington, D.C.
Of course.
You've done the journey from Abraham Lincoln's memorial to the Washington Memorial onto the Jefferson Memorial. We've seen the U.S. Capitol. We've, the White House. It's our history, and it's beautiful. This is Russian history. This is their equivalent.
Yeah.
And they have so much right to be proud of this.
And I'm going to say this again, and I know for those of you watching us, you've heard me say this before, but it's only because I was flabbergasted when I came to this place. As I've gotten to know Moscow in the last 2 or 3 months that I've been here, I have found that it's a place with very little to no crime, little to no homelessness, little to no drug addiction, little to no immigration issues, and one of the most unified places where there's a real sense of brotherhood that I've ever experienced in my entire life. And I only say that not to criticize my country, because I adore my country. And as an immigrant to my country, you can only imagine how much I have to be appreciative for the opportunities that I was given it. But those things that I just named a little while ago, they don't exist in our country today. They don't.
No, we have work to do.
And those are problems that we've got to solve.
And the thing about it is, we can't solve those problems if we're diverting trillions of dollars into...
$300 billion for Ukraine.
Well, forget Ukraine. Now, Ukraine's lost the war. We can get into that in a minute. But I don't mean forget, because so much sacrifice has been made, et cetera. But that's a decided issue, no matter what Donald Trump thinks.
Yeah.
But we have a New START treaty that expires on February 4th of next year. And if that expires and it's not extended, we're into a new arms race. Russia's got the lead. They've built all these new weapons, Oreshnik and others. Ryabkov just came out and said, yeah, we got more that we haven't told you about.
Yeah.
They've got the Sarmat. They got Avangard. They've got this new Skyfall system. What do we have? Old Minuteman III, aging Tridents, and B-52 bombers.
Out of Patriots.
Yeah, we're out of Patriots. But the point is, we're going to have to spend, in order to compete, trillions of dollars. On top of that, Donald Trump speaking of building this Golden Dome missile defense shield. Somebody needs to educate him on the history of arms control. Yeah. Missile defense doesn't work,
right.
Will never work. That's why we signed the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, 1972, right here. Richard Nixon, Brezhnev, they signed it. You know Ray McGovern, our good friend, the
of
CIA
course. Yeah.
Ray McGovern was here as part of the CIA arms control team.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Ray was here in Moscow making history. But the point is, we withdrew from that treaty. The INF treaty that I was part of that got rid of the dangerous intermediate range missiles, we withdrew, Donald Trump withdrew from that treaty. And now the last remaining arms control treaty of note, New START, is about to expire.
That's great.
If we want to take care of homelessness, education problems, infrastructure, imagine if we could divert trillions of dollars over the course of 10 years into those projects, what a great country the United States of America would be. Look,
I want a safer world we would have.
We definitely would have it. I think we're in a transition period. I'm very optimistic about America. I love the American people. I am the American people. I wake up every morning knowing what I'm capable of doing, what my core values are, what my core beliefs are. And I know that there's hundreds of millions of Americans that share those values. And we're going to win. It's a struggle, though. It's a struggle. And if we make life difficult by making bad relations with Russia, we just make it impossible for us to turn the corner at home. This is why peace with Russia is so important.
And here's where we are right now. And now I'm going to give you a little bit of the bad news. As our president sits down with the president of Russia tomorrow in Alaska, these are the kind of questions that he is being asked at the news conference. This is Mr. Trump just yesterday fielding questions at the Kennedy Center from reporters. And look at one of the first questions he's asked. And look at the tone with which this question is phrased. Take this, if you could, Gene.
Will Russia face any consequences if Vladimir Putin does not agree to stop the war after your meeting on Friday?
Yes, they will. Yeah.
What will the consequences be?
There will be,
Sanctions, tariffs?
There will be, I don't have to say, there will be very severe consequences, yes.
What will be the consequences for Mr. Putin if he doesn't agree to what you tell him to do? I mean, what kind of imbecilic question is that from a reporter? And for those of you who have not lived in the United States, that's unfortunately what the media in the United States has kind of turned into. And I said this to Scott a little while ago, and I don't know if he disagrees with me. I'm a member of the media. I worked at CNN, I worked at Fox, I worked at NBC, I worked at all those places. I would not be surprised if that reporter was handed that question by an insider or some kind of neocon, because he wanted him to ask it so the president could give him that answer.
Look, we're in the state of information. First of all, I agree with you. I think that was a planted question. And I think President Trump had a scripted answer. Why is he saying that?
Yeah.
You know, I've been here for a couple of days, and I've asked Russian officials and Russian experts and this that same question. They're not worried about that. Because what they say is, and I agree with them, that there will be a meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. And that meeting will be held with the utmost mutual respect.
Yeah.
President Trump knows that you can't bully President Putin. And plus, it's just, if you want the meeting to fail, that's how you make it fail. I believe the Russians are looking at this and realizing, see, Vladimir Putin's been the president of Russia for 25 years, or president, prime minister, but a leader for 25 years. And the Russian people know who he is. He just had an election last March, not last March, but the March prior, which he won with overwhelming votes. He has the support of the Russian people. He has the support of the Russian government. He doesn't have to look behind him.
Yeah.
He can focus on going forward. Donald Trump, you know, the MAGA base wants peace with Russia, but Russophobia prevents us from understanding the complexities and realities of that. So they think they want peace, but they don't know how to get there, and they're still vulnerable to, you know, oh, you've caved into Putin, you're a Putin puppet, you're all this. And so Trump has to watch his six. He's trying to move forward, but he has to keep looking backwards over his shoulder for the deep state, for the Democrats, for the neocons, everybody to come after him and take him apart. He needs to hold them off. So he says these things to bluff them, not to bluff Russia. Russia can't be bluffed. Putin can't
be
bluffed.
It's almost like, you know, I'm hearing you say this. It's almost like this is what Trump wants and instinctually probably believes. And then this is what is being whispered in his ear by some powerful people who've been whispering that since they got rid of JFK.
Well, we know this is the truth. I mean,
am I right?
Yeah. Look, what does Keith Kellogg tell Donald Trump? What does Marco Rubio tell Donald Trump? These people don't love Russia. They hate Russia. That's the opposite. Steve Witkoff is a wonderful man. He came here. But he's a messenger. He's not a policy maker. He's a policy implementer. Pete Hegseth, no offense. You know, the man maxed out at battalion command. He's not a four-star general. He was a Fox News talking head. And now he's the Secretary of Defense. He doesn't know a damn thing about, excuse my language, a darn thing about Russia. So Trump is not surrounded by people who know Russia. They don't understand Russia. This is the great danger. Donald Trump knows what he wants. He wants peace with Russia. But he also understands that this is an extraordinarily difficult political problem for him. And so he has to say a lot of things to put out fires before.
Well, here's the proof of that, as a matter of fact, Scott, because we've got a second take. Gene, I think we've got this now. Here's Mr. Trump saying, right after he said there will be consequences if Mr. Putin doesn't agree right away, he comes back and said, oh, no. We're going to meet again. Here, let's take a listen.
There's a very good chance that we're going to have a second meeting, which will be more productive than the first, because the first is I'm going to find out where we are and what we're doing. If the first one goes okay, we'll have a quick second one. I would like to do it almost immediately, and we'll have a quick second meeting between President Putin and President Zelensky and myself, if they'd like to have me there. And that would be a meeting where maybe it could be absolutely work. But the first meeting will not work that out. Certain great things can be gained in the first. It's going to be a very important meeting, but it's setting the table.
What do you make of that?
Well, he knows darn well what's going to happen. I mean, as I said, presidents don't meet by accident. Their agenda is not, you know, a surprise. His team and Vladimir Putin's team have already worked out the agenda. They've already worked out the joint statement. There might be some things that have to be discussed, finalized in a private conversation. But I believe that what the decisions that will come out of this summit have already been made. These presidents just need to meet each other, talk about it, work it through. Putin has to put his magic on Trump to convince him. He's a very convincing person. Trump will hopefully be in listen mode and all that. This is a trap for Zelensky. And I think that's why the Russians agree. I can't speak on behalf of the Russian government. I don't know. But, you know, Zelensky will not play ball. I mean, Vladimir Putin has made it clear what the Russian conditions are, and it's clear that Zelensky will never accept them. Mm-hmm. So as long as Vladimir Putin can say Russia's willing to do this, 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 and this to bring it into the war, but first Ukraine has to withdraw from the totality of territories or whatever, and Trump says, okay, Now Trump calls up Zelensky, says, I'm ready for the meeting, baby. I'm ready for the meeting. Mm-hmm. Putin wants the meeting. You got to come. And Zelensky's going to go, no.
Yeah.
Now, who are going to have the consequences? Trump said there's going to be consequences. It's not Vladimir Putin who's going to have the consequences. It's going to be Zelensky.
Zelensky's already saying no. As a matter of fact, here he is saying that these people are suffering. Look behind us, right? Look at them. Are they suffering? Do they look to you like they're suffering? Here's a soundbite of Zelensky saying that the sanctions are destroying Russia. Look, we're here. I'm telling you, Russia's not destroyed, okay? The people of Russia are not being destroyed. Their economy could be better, but it's not going through some period of suffrage. And he also then says that, interestingly enough, and I found this interesting, that Vladimir Putin wants to take over all of Ukraine, which is another, I think, falsehood. Take a listen for yourself.
I told President Trump and all our European allies, Putin is bluffing. He's trying to push before the Alaska meeting on all directions of our front line. Russia wants to occupy the whole of Ukraine. This is his wish. And Putin is bluffing that sanctions is nothing and they don't work. In fact, sanctions are hitting Russian war economy hard. It's true. Russia has a lot of weapons, many times over than we have. Artillery, let's say, for three times more. But they sustaining three times more losses.
I mean, just facts alone. Forget anything else. Whether you hate Putin, love Putin, hate Trump, love Zelensky, hate Zelensky. Take all of that out of your mind right now and just look at this picture. The man from a country where people are on the streets protesting about all the corruption that is going on in his country. The man from a country where people are being snatched off the streets because they really don't want the fight. The man from a country where the polls show 60% of people don't like him and want the war to end is criticizing a country where all of those things are the converse.
Yeah, Zelensky,
I mean, not for nothing, dude, but those are the facts right now.
I think it was an episode of Seinfeld where it was opposite. Everything was the opposite. All right, so Zelensky lives in the opposite world, meaning that whatever he says, the exact opposite is the case. You know, he's always been a tool of the West, you know, from the very beginning. The whole way that Zelensky came into power was literally as a tool of MI6, mm-hmm. you know, working in cahoots with Kolomovsky and Ukrainian oligarchs and all that. I mean, they created a TV program, Servant of the People, where he played a simple man being the president to implant in the minds of the Ukrainian people the possibility of him being president.
Wow.
And then as
think
soon,
about that. Well, and it became a reality.
It became a reality. He campaigned on a program of peace. But as soon as he became president, he was promoting war because that's what his Western masters told him to do. Zelensky's reading from a script. The British are writing the script. The British are, sadly, some of the worst enemies of Russia one can imagine.
Yeah.
They are pushing war. But the sad thing is, the Brits, they're not the ones dying. It's the Ukrainians that are dying. They've allowed themselves to become a proxy, a tool of a nation, Great Britain, and allies in Europe, unfortunately previously backed by the United States, that sought to use Ukraine as a tool to strategically defeat Russia. Sanctions were supposed to strangle the economy. It didn't work. By strangling the economy, these people here, instead of walking these streets in peace, were supposed to come together in a Maidan-like moment. They call
right.
it the Moscow Maidan. They're supposed to assemble here to bring down the government of Vladimir Putin, which was is all about. We hate Putin because he's rebuilt Russia.
Yeah.
We hate Putin because Russia now stands on its feet. We hate Putin because Russians love being Russians today. They love themselves. They love who they are. They're a proud people. What we want is for Russia to go back to the time of the 1990s. Boris Yeltsin, controlled by Bill Clinton. Russia, totally controlled and used by the United States, subservient to us. The Russians will never again bend the knee to the West. And Great Britain can't handle that. So Zelensky, as a tool of Great Britain, reads their script. And the script is literally the exact opposite, because it's information warfare. It's not about the truth.
Yeah.
You know what the truth is? Russian troops are breaking through on the front lines.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. By the way, you know, we always say we like to talk about facts, right? Let's make sure we're talking about facts. Western polling organization comes to Russia every year and does a poll, like they do in most countries, by the way, and they want to determine what the favorability is of Mr. Putin and his government at this time. The last time they took that poll, Mr. Putin was at 85%. Interestingly enough, 20 years ago, he was around 51%.
Yeah.
So he's climbed quite a bit. And that's a very impressive number when you consider some of the things, some of the numbers that we see, for example, in the United States and in other Western countries. Any Western leader would die for anything over 60%.
Yeah.
And here's a guy doing 85%.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, and we ain't lying, as they say in Brooklyn, right? These people like him. And they're happy with their lives, and they're confident. There's a lot of things they don't like about him, and they're critical about him. And if you go here and you sit at a bar, you'll hear him criticize President Putin out loud, like I just did recently when I was over here across the street. But generally speaking, the people are content with the things, the way things are going.
This is what I found.
That's what I've seen, okay?
It's the same thing. You know, I've been fortunate enough not just to be in Moscow's a beautiful city, but the problem is it's the Moscow trap. You come to Moscow, and it doesn't matter how real this is, and this is as real as it gets. You go back to the United States and you say, oh, I was in Moscow. That's a Potemkin village. They put all the money into it. That's not it. Okay, I've been to Novosibirsk.
Yeah.
Is that a Potemkin village?
St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg is also, they say, oh, well, that's where they put more money into.
Yeah.
Irkutsk. Is that a Potemkin village? Ekaterinburg, Volgograd, Kazan. Are these Potemkin villages? And everywhere I go, I sit down, and what I hear is, you know, they go, I support Vladimir Putin and all that, but I have questions. Or yeah. I support our government, they're doing a good job, but I have concerns. Meaning that this isn't blind support.
Yeah.
These aren't people that
no.
are brainwashed. These are some of the most intelligent people, articulate people, politically connected people. I would say the average Russian knows more about the United States than the average American
does. No question.
And so
when you have
a conversation with these people, this isn't superficiality. This isn't, you know, people with superficial. When you ask them a question, man, you get some depth. And so don't ask them a question unless you want to sit down for about 30, 40 minutes and get an answer. But they will give you an answer that's
fact-based. They talk too much? Is that what you say?
Not talk too much. They talk enough.
They're loquacious.
Well, they're loquacious because they're intelligent.
Yeah.
They're loquacious because
exactly.
they have a soul. But my point is, this isn't a bunch of robots.
Yeah.
These are human beings who think. They just happen to live in a country where the government takes care of the people.
And that's a big difference, by the way. Speaking of the man, here's Vladimir Putin. I think if you could say anything about Mr. Putin, it's that he has been consistent from the very beginning, describing to the West and to whoever will hear him at the White House about what he needs and what his conditions are for this thing to be over the next day. And here he is laying those out.
Our conditions for starting such a conversation are simple. Ukrainian troops must be completely withdrawn from the Donetsk and Lugansk republics and the Kherson and Zaporozhye regions. As soon as Kiev declares that it is ready for such a decision and begins a real withdrawal of troops from these regions, and also officially declares that it has abandoned plans to join NATO, an order from our side will immediately follow to cease fire and begin negotiations. We are ready to begin negotiations without delay. I repeat that it is our principled position that Ukraine's status is neutral, non-aligned, nuclear-free, demilitarized, and denazified.
I heard you say this morning with Napolitano, good guy, by the way. What I just heard there is basically two conditions. Give us, you know, get out of the Russian area that we are now, those four oblasts, four territories, provinces or states, wherever you're from, anywhere in the world, and be neutral. Don't become a part of NATO. We don't care what you believe in, but you can't be anti-Russia and you can't be plants that are anti-Russia. Those look, it's like two conditions, right? That's it.
For a ceasefire.
Yeah.
Get out of Russia. These aren't, you know, this isn't tokenism here. Russia has constitutionally absorbed these territories. They are Mother Russia. And historically speaking, they are Russian territories. If you study the history of that, and a case could be made that Odessa, Kharkiv, Dnepropetrovsk,
right.
Mykolaiv are Russia. But notice, Zelensky said Vladimir Putin's trying to take over all of Ukraine.
He's not.
He just made it clear. And I want to remind people, too, Russia didn't start this war to own Kherson, Zaporizhia. And they didn't even start this war to absorb Donetsk and Lugansk. When the war started, the Russian conditions that were agreed to at Istanbul in April of 2022, Russia would have returned Kherson and Zaporizhia to Ukraine. It was simply a military operation to create a land bridge. But Russia was going to give that back. And the Donbas wasn't going to be absorbed. Russia said that it needs to be independent and they need to be allowed to make their own decision. Hmm. It was only when the United States injected $48 billion, rebuilt the Ukrainian army, and sent them on offensive that Russia said, okay, now that you've made this decision, now we're going to take the Don. We had referendum. The people decide they want to join Russia. Constitutionally, they became Russia. So these territories are Russian. They're not a tokenism. This isn't a gimmick. This isn't a trick. When Vladimir Putin says, you must leave this territory, it's the same thing as when he says you must leave Lugansk and Donetsk, it's the same thing as saying if there's Ukrainians in Moscow, you must leave Moscow.
Right.
Zaporizhia is every bit of Russian as Moscow is. It's part of Mother Russia. Americans need to understand that because there's people saying freeze along the line of contact and all this. Russia won't.
By the way, this is another point that, you know, I think a lot of people who watch this know and a lot of people in the West don't know. A lot of those areas, Mariupol, for example, the Russians have since, in the last year, they've gone in there and spent billions of dollars, schools, new roads, everything that was knocked down, they've rebuilt. So, yeah. You know, when you put a lot of money and put a lot of time and you put a lot of, you know, reconstruction into these areas, you kind of deserve to own it. And the people over there are very grateful for that. So that kind of goes into the equation as well, doesn't it?
When you have the blood of Russian soldiers spilled into the soil, it becomes Mother Russia. Go to Volgograd. Look at the statue.
Yeah.
Mamayev Kurgan. The motherland calls.
Yeah.
The mother beckoning.
That's a part of the culture.
Beckoning her sons to go forward and defeat the enemy. But if you, as you approach the statue, you come up to the top and there's a pond that's from the tears of the mother holding her dead son. And Americans don't get it. This is Russia. This is what they believe in. And so when the mothers of Russia today send their sons off, it's not an adventure to conquer Ukraine.
No.
They say, protect the homeland, protect the motherland.
Right.
And that's what this is about.
That's what I think, Scott, our president doesn't understand.
No, somebody
needs
to explain it to
him. I hope he does. And I hope somebody explains this to him before he sits down tomorrow with Mr. Putin. But this
Rick,
the land swap.
Rick, the U.S. Embassy is watching this show right now. All right? Let's send a message to the U.S. ambassador. Hey, guys, you hear what we're talking about? This is the message you need to send to Donald Trump, because what we're talking about is real, and the president needs to know this stuff.
It's
now
not
we've
a
challenged
land swap.
Them.
It's not a land swap.
No, it's not a land swap.
Mr. Putin does not need more land. What he wants is security for these people. These people want to wake up in the morning and know that there's not a missile headed their way from inside Ukraine.
But he also wants security for the people who live in Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk.
Yeah.
I had an important meeting with Yana, and I'll butcher her last name, so I won't do it. But she's a member of the State Duma. She's a human rights person. In 2014, she was a young volunteer, and she went to Donetsk and Lugansk and the territories to rescue children that were caught in the firefights. The courage of this lady is unbelievable. Mm. She went through the shells. She got the wounded children. The photographs are heartbreaking. And she brought them out and she rescued them. She was labeled a terrorist by the Ukrainians for this action.
Yeah.
She was put under sanctions for rescuing children. But this is what Vladimir Putin is defending. These people are safe, okay?
Yes.
It's the citizens of the Donbas, the citizens of Kherson, the citizens of Zaporizhia who live under constant shelling. And the Ukrainians, when they shell using American weapons,
yes,
they shell not military targets, they deliberately, because these are high precision weapon systems, and Ukrainians are getting the best intelligence from the United States. So when they target, when they hit a hospital, it's because they wanted to hit a hospital. When they hit a bakery during the morning rush hour, when the mothers are out there getting the bread for their family, they wanted to hit that bakery. They want to hit this home. They do it on purpose with our weapons. That's who Vladimir Putin is protecting. That's why this is being done. This is why Russian soldiers are dying, because those are Russian citizens there. and they deserve the protection of the state, just like American citizens deserve the protection of the state. God forbid somebody moved in and invaded the United States, or, you know, and it did this, and we had Americans dying. Why do you think President Trump is so adamant about border security? The same passion that President Trump puts into border security, and the Americans insist we need to secure our borders to prevent crime from waving over, that same passion. Imagine now if you lived in San Diego, and from Tijuana, rockets were coming in and hitting, you know, the stadium, hitting the hospitals, hitting the roads. How would you feel if hundreds of children died? You know, Americans just don't get it. This lady's story must be told. It must be told, but it can't be told now because we're told it's propaganda.
Right. You know? Right. No, truth matters. And, you know, there's an irony here as well. And the irony is, as I've seen it, the Russian military is stronger today, by all accounts, than it ever has been. Some of its weaponry is extremely, extremely high end, and perhaps more so than it would have been had the United States not provoked this war with Ukraine. You talk a lot about this Oreshnik rocket that apparently the Russians are using now. It's probably as state-of-the-art weaponry as there exists in the world right now, you know, outside of nuclear stuff.
Well, first of all, it's a nuclear-capable missile. The Oreshnik is an analog of the SS-20 missile, which started the whole INF crisis, a road mobile missile.
And we have some video of this, by the way. This is what it looks like as Scott describes it. Go ahead.
Well, gosh, I'd love to see the video because I'm glad somebody has a picture of it. It's a secret system. Yeah. The Russians are fairly tight-lipped about it, but
we have what we're just what if you guys are seeing this video now, what we're describing is you're not seeing the actual rockets, you're seeing the assault of the rockets as they're hitting
The Oreshnik is an SS-20 analog. It's a missile of a certain range that has the capability of hitting multiple targets. The SS-20 used three nuclear warheads. The Oreshnik has six warheads, and each warhead has six submunitions. Oreshnik means hazelnut. And if you look at the system coming down at night especially, it looks like a hazelnut tree in bloom, in blossom. That's where the name comes from. It's a new missile, according to President Putin, and he doesn't lie, so I trust him. Mm-hmm. The first stage appears to be a derivative of a stage produced for the Cedar intercontinental ballistic missile. The second stage appears to be a derivative of the YARS system. The post boost vehicle and the warheads, the bus, appears to be a version of the advanced YAR system, modified for this. But it's an all-new missile with intermediate range. That means it could go, you know, 5,000 kilometers. It could hit anywhere in Europe.
So how big a differentiator is it?
It's a game changer. It can't be shot
down.
Do
we have anything like that in the United States?
No. It can't be shot down. And it gives the Russians escalation options because the SS-20 was only nuclear. With the Oreshnik, the Russians can choose to use a conventional strike. Yeah. So let's say the Germans are stupid enough to give the Ukrainians Taurus missiles, and the Ukrainians are stupid enough to fire one into Moscow. You know, that would give the Russians a right to use nuclear weapons, but they won't. They're smart, I believe. But the Oreshnik now could take out the Dusseldorf production facility where the Taurus is built using conventional
weapons. In Germany.
And there's nothing the Germans could do. There's nothing NATO could do. Wow. There's not a... And this is what the Russians have said. I think Dmitry Medvedev made this statement in a tweet. All of the beautiful cathedrals of all the beautiful European cities will now lie in ruins because if you want to go to war with us, this missile can hit everything and take it off. It's in serial production day. You know where they produce it? Votkinsk, the place that I used to work at.
Wow.
So the Oreshnik is a big deal. But, you know, that's one game changer. You know what the real game changer is? Drones.
You told me that. Remember, you were on my podcast back when I was in Miami, and you told me the development of the drones, and not just the development of them, but the way that they have then developed during warfare is so sophisticated now that you have to be in one of those wars to be able to understand how they work.
I had the honor and privilege of talking to Abdi Aladinov, the famous Chechen commander, Russian commander of the Chechen Akhmat Special Forces, a warrior. I mean, a hero of Russia. I was able to talk to him during this visit, and I discussed drone warfare with him. He said that the way the war is being fought today in in the Ukrainian war, if you used Cold War tactics, if I suddenly lost 20 years of age and could move and was asked mm-hmm. to command troops in combat, the tactics that I know, the things that I learned, which were very effective back in the day, we wouldn't last a day on the modern battlefield. There's no more mass tank attacks. You said you put 1,000 tanks in the field, you'll have 1,000 burning tanks within 30 minutes. The drones have made mass attacks impossible. Wow. We're now talking about, for instance, for the Russians, for them to approach the front lines, they have a 30-kilometer dead zone, meaning as they enter, the Ukrainians are sending drones in, and you're at risk. The Ukrainians have the same thing, but the Russians can take it up to 40, 50 kilometers. A battle now is planned with drones from start to beginning. Surveillance drones, fire support drones, jamming drones. It's literally a whole different kind of war. We don't understand it in the West. NATO's not prepared to fight it. General Kovoli.
How did Russia get so good at this, just from the experience of this thing in Ukraine?
Yeah, look, with the
Because they weren't so good at the beginning, were they?
No, well, nobody was, because nobody did it.
Yeah.
The irony of this thing here is that the drone warfare wasn't pushed from the top down. The top had a different way of doing drone warfare. They're sort of our way with big drones, surveillance drones, firing missiles, and all that. It was the troops on the ground that said, we need to change the game here. So first they got commercially available drones that were provided by citizens.
Yeah.
And they came, the government didn't give it to them. Russian citizens would raise money and drive to the front and give these guys. And the Russian soldiers created their own drone units and they started using them for reconnaissance. And then the Russian soldiers and the Ukrainians were doing the same thing. The Ukrainians are very advanced in drone warfare.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, they're putting grenades on them and they're flying over and dropping the grenades. And then they said, why don't we just strap an explosive on it? And now we use it as a suicide drone, those FPV drones. Now, drones are like radio controlled things, so they can be jammed. And so there's a whole this electronic warfare stuff going on. So the Russians said, why don't we put a fiber optic cable on it? And so you can't jam it. So the fiber optic comes in, gives you a clear point of view, hit up. If you look at the battlefields today, and this is what Americans need to look at. If you go to the front line and look at the battlefields, the fields are covered with the strings of the fiber optic cable, and it literally blanketed it like a bed of threads. That's how many drones are being used. The drones are being used by the thousands every day, and you know, it's just a whole new way, and if you're not ready for that, you will die. I was trained in tactics.
So military advantages come about through progression.
Through progression and through practice.
Yeah.
This is a laboratory that's taking place today, a war laboratory. The two most proficient militaries in the world for drone warfare are the Ukrainians and the Russians. And the Ukrainians are pretty damn good. Just ask the Russians. The Ukrainians are good. But you know what the Russians have done? Because the Ukrainians were so good, the Russians put a lot of emphasis into counter-drone warfare, meaning that they do a pattern of life, how the Ukrainian drone teams come out, what kind of vehicles they use.
Yeah.
They have their surveillance. And as soon as they detect it, then the Iskander hits them or a Fab 300 hits them. The most dangerous job in the Ukrainian military today isn't frontline infantrymen. It's a drone operator. If you operate a drone against the Russians, they're going to hunt you down and kill you. That's why the Russians are having such great success.
So we're coming down to the last couple of minutes of this interview. And by the way, I could go on forever with you because you're so knowledgeable, Scott. And I so appreciate you being here. This is really important.
I really appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you. Thank you.
And
what a beautiful background.
And the view.
Yeah, this is my apartment. No, it's not. Let's talk about the actual war effort. Pokrovsk, the Russians are already there. If they're not there, they're knocking on the door. It's looking like that's going to go any moment now, if it hasn't already. It looks like after that, the Russians are probably going to take most of those supply lines and most of that area.
Yeah.
How would you assess the situation right now for both sides?
I mean, for Russia, this has been a war of attrition. It's been difficult for us in the West to understand this. First of all, we don't understand the war. I just described a drone warfare that nobody in the West comprehends. So we're expecting a certain pace of operations and all that. That's not how this works. It's a slower pace. Plus, the Russians aren't in the business of sacrificing men. This is not the Rzhev meat grinder of World War II, where the Russians lost 2 million men to hold the Germans in place. Donald Trump, his fantasy of the number of dead Russians is just that fantasy. Are Russians dying? You're damn right they are. This is war. It's high-intensity conflict. It's deadly warfare. But they're not dying in those numbers, and they're not dying anywhere close to the numbers that the Ukrainians are. the Russians have to advance, but they do it in a methodical measure, in a measured way. And the thing is, when the Russians reach a brick wall, they're not Marines. What do Marines do? We put our head down and we try and ram through the brick wall. That's what we're good at. The Russians say, okay, pull back and try to outflank them, come in from different directions. They focus on supply lines, choking off the Ukrainians so that the Ukrainians will then withdraw. And now through drone warfare, once you leave your prepared position, you become exposed and you get hit. As they try to replenish them, they get hit. The Russians are dominating this battlefield. And right now, the Ukrainians have run out of manpower. They, you know, it used to be able to plug a gap here. They had strategic reserves. They went into Kursk, lost almost 80,000 men. That was their strategic reserve. They don't have any left. Now, in order to plug a gap, they have to rob Peter to pay Paul. They'll pull a brigade out of here, put it there. But as soon as they pull the brigade out, the Russians attack here. Yeah. And then they advance, and they have to bring in a brigade here. And the Russians are dominant along the entire line of contact. And right now, the Ukrainians are just bleeding troops, bleeding equipment. We are on the verge of total collapse. My prediction is this. Take a snapshot of the battlefield today.
Okay.
Take a snapshot of the battlefield in a month. I'll bet you that they're not even close, that the Russians will advance, which is the greatest negotiating tool Vladimir Putin has, because he has battlefield reality. Every day the Russians are advancing. Every day Donald Trump's being briefed on the inevitability of Russian victory.
Mm.
Donald Trump knows now that if you want peace, the Ukrainians need to yield to the Russian demands and give the Russians Mother Russia. Because if they don't, this war machine that the Russians have, they're already in Dnepropetrovsk. Wait till they take over and they go into Kherson, they start advancing to Mykolaiv, then they flank out into Odessa. As they advance further in the Sumy.
Do you think they will? I mean,
if the Ukrainians don't surrender, Russia will never yield the advantage.
Yeah.
This advantage that they have right now is from attritional warfare. It has been earned in the blood of tens of thousands of Russian soldiers who have sacrificed their lives so that Russia could be at this position. Do you really think the Russian leadership, after so much sacrifice, is going to yield that sacrifice?
Yeah.
This is why they say there can't be a ceasefire until certain conditions have been met. And if those conditions aren't met, full bore, go, and it'll be the defeat of the Ukraine.
So what you're basically saying is that it's up to Donald Trump to come up with some way to save Ukraine.
Yes.
It's not about Russia. This is about saving Ukraine. If they can't come up with, I mean, Vladimir Putin seemed to say, I heard him say there a little while ago, do this and we'll stop.
I think
we'll have a ceasefire the next day.
Vladimir Putin, again, he's the Russian president. I can't speak for him, but my guess is that he is going to give Donald Trump the ground truth. And he's going to say, look, Mr. President, this is the reality here. I don't know what your people are telling you. The thing about 20,000 dead is just bonkers.
Right. Yeah.
The reality is we're winning. We're winning decisively.
Yep.
Every day our advantages accrue greater. I'm willing just to keep this war going as long as necessary if our conditions aren't met. I would like this war to end. I know you want this war to end. Okay, but you have to respect Russian reality. This is Mother Russia. We're not stopping until we get this. And if they don't allow that and we have to keep fighting, then we will.
Well, he's Scott Ritter. He's honest, he's earnest, and it's a pleasure to have him and an honor to have him here. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you so much for being there. We'll be looking for you again right here very soon. Don't forget to catch me on Journalistically Speaking. Some of the highlights of this may appear there. In fact, I know they will. We'll be looking for you next time. Good night from Moscow.